My name's Joe, and I am an alcoholic, proud member of Beyond Belief Agnostics Free Thinkers Groups, a regular at the meeting that is taking part today, the Queen Street West Secular Tuesday Afternooner, back in the day, face-to-face place and virtual. I'm also on the International Conference of Secular AA Committee. And if you haven't heard already, the face-to-face October 28th, 29th, 20th, 30th, fourth biennial conference in Washington has been canceled for health reasons, and we are replacing it with Hollywood Squares AA. We are doing 2 days of Zoom, the 29th and the 30th. We hope everyone can attend our general members meeting. Many of the members of the board or committee, whatever you want to call it, were going to rotate out in 2020 when we were going to meet in Washington then and elect new people to participate. We're going to do that virtually. It'll be the first time we do that. That'll be on the Sunday. Details to follow. Through the course of the day, we'll put some information about a planning meeting for the program on the 29th and 30th. And we've already got some ideas, suggestions, questions at secularaa@gmail.com. And we welcome other ideas. In fact, there won't be much we would say no to. So if you've got an idea, a panel, a speaker, some way you would like to participate, if we can accommodate it, we certainly will. So let's see. Let's get the fun part of this meeting done, and I might interject with some other announcement-y type things as some of the other planning committee members are who are here today. The participants don't even know what order they're going to go in. Just the way you appear on my screen, it's going to be Mark first, then Elise, then David W. Yeah, I'm not going to say a whole lot more. These are all people I've gotten to know, a couple in person, one on Zoom. Ladies and gentlemen and all others, Mark R.
Hey, everybody. Quick question before I get started. Joe, how long would you like us to share today?
We'll mute you if you go on too long. 10 to 20 is fine.
Well, thanks very much. Everybody, again, as David said, my name's Mark. I'm an addict and alcoholic, and I spent a lot of time in the agnostic program when I was early on here. It was a good entry point for me. Somebody here was smart enough to point out to me that rather than looking for the differences between this and conventional AA, perhaps I might find the things it had in common and take from it what works. And, you know, that was really good advice, because when I got in here, I knew everything and I was splitting hairs about what was right and wrong and how this might work and this might not and this will and won't work for me. And you know what? Nonsense. If you show up and get involved with the people here, put your hand up and ask for some help, things get better. It's that simple. I've just got a few minutes, so I'm going to chat a bit about my experience, strength, and hope here. As a kid, I found drugs and alcohol early in life. My family's got a bunch of drunks in it. You know, my grandparents on both sides were some very drunk, aggressive human beings, and they were very aggressive with both of my parents. And my parents made a pact to not carry that into our household. So I don't know what it is to have my brains beaten in by a drunk father or anything, but I do know what it is to have an addict for a parent. When I was a child, one of my siblings was killed in an accident. A whole bunch of kids got killed with her. And frankly, my father kind of snapped and he never really came back from it. My mother doesn't drink in the house. She has a drink on Christmas. She'll have a drink on New Year's and maybe on her birthday, but that's about it. She's really got no use for it. My father, on the other hand, did this. Well, he hid it. He hid his use. And in a lot of ways, he used me as an accomplice to do it. He would take me hiking for the day with him, or, you know, going out someplace. And that would be an opportunity for him to get lit and then head on back home. And usually he'd use me as a little accomplice. And as a young person, it taught me that it's okay to lie and do what you got to do. You know, if that's what it takes to make your habit work, that's what you do, because it's nobody else's business anyway. I tucked that little message away in the back of my mind for when I got a little older and found drugs and alcohol myself. The first time I got properly loaded, I was, probably 8 or 10 years old, drinking wine in a friend's basement and a sleepover, and thought, wow, this feels great. I feel fantastic. And I did. I felt really warm and confident. And, that scared person I usually was, I didn't feel that way. And going forward, that's usually what booze did for me. That's what drugs did for me. They changed my normal state of being and feeling to something that felt more acceptable. You know, when things felt insurmountable, they were there for me and it worked. When I was scared to do anything, again, it worked. It's confidence in a bottle or a bump or anything else for that matter. And when things were really horrible, it made me not feel, which got really useful later on in the process of being an addict. When I was a kid, most of the people I looked up to were drunks and addicts, is what we would presently describe them, and I thought they were all pretty cool. But by the time I got to be about 30 years of age, I started to understand that most of my heroes were either dead or incarcerated. And that was, in my friend group as well. Like, a lot of the people I thought were really cool cats growing up were just, they're not coming back. And drugs and alcohol took them all in one way or another. And when I was in my 40s, I started to reassess my life a little bit. I tried everything to sort my life out because obviously I can do this myself. I'm not a drunk. I'm not a drug addict. I don't need anyone's help. I'm going to read some books. I probably read every self-help book you can find in the library or bookstore. I literally poured through hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And nothing changed because I didn't change. I had this idea that somehow something other than drugs or alcohol was what was helping me burn my life down. It was some little thing I had to adjust. And really, there was a fundamental change I needed to make. I'm a dependent. I'm dependent on drugs and alcohol and sex. And without those things, my life's terrible. It's really boring. The truth is, in retrospect, I realize now that I was boring. I just didn't have much going on other than, like, I know how to drink like the rest of them. And I can go out and be a mess like everyone else and act like a clown. But as long as I do that, I've really got no redeeming qualities to myself or my life. So, of course, without it, everything's terrible. I got involved in the program because I got to a point where I realized I tried to quit and I couldn't. I had a business I'd started. And we had to get insurance for all the founding members of the business. And I was advised by the person issuing our insurance to possibly clean out for 30 days, because otherwise it might be some problems when they come to do blood work. That was a really tough 30 days. I kept my nose clean. I didn't drink. I didn't do anything. And in about 40 days, somebody from the insurance company got hold of me and said, wow, we haven't seen anything like this in a long time. We found about 7 different substances in your bloodstream. You might want to cut it out. Maybe go see a doctor while you're at it. But as things stand today, you are uninsurable. I'm sorry, we cannot insure you. And I thought, I did everything I'm supposed to do. I've been sober for a whole month. And that wasn't cutting it. Now, I mean, as soon as they got out of the door from testing me, I was back on the horse again and doing exactly what I was doing before. But it was the first time where I started to get an inkling that maybe, other people aren't like this. I thought that's what people did when they had a modicum of success. They had enough money to drink and drug as much as they like. Because as long as you got money in the bank and you're gainfully employed, what's the problem? Well, it's a big problem. I had a friend, he was my best friend for years. I worked and toured with him, and he was always a bigger drunk than me. He was a bigger mess than me, a bigger addict than me. So I can't be that bad because I'm not him. And he got in the program years ahead of me. And in the years he was in the program, frankly, we stopped hanging out because I was probably not very interesting to be around for a guy like him that was living clean and doing well and going places in his life. My life was still a dumpster fire. But as the years went on, I watched his life get better. Time I saw him, he just, his eyes looked a little brighter. Something else great was happening in his life. And generally speaking, when we touch base, I just burned something else down in my life. And around the time of my 45th birthday, I decided I was going to straighten up. Went for dinner with him that night. I just buggered up something really important in my life. Again, I'm sure I was in control of things. And I asked him if I could possibly come hang out and join his cult. Went to a Tuesday men's meeting a couple of days later. And that was really hard because I was sure I could get through to a meeting at 5 in the afternoon without using anything that day. And truth be told, I was wasted when I got there. I was really nervous to go because I didn't think they'd let me in the room. So if you're new here today and you're not sure about whether or not you belong, yeah, you do. We'll take anybody. We're happy you're here. I was a goddamn mess when I got through the door, and nobody looked at me sideways. Nobody gave me a hard time. Nobody said boo. The only thing I really did that caused any trouble was there's a 10-minute meditation at the start of the meeting. And while everyone sat there quietly, my breathing sounded like Darth Vader. I'd smoked a pack of cigarettes that day and too much pot to be normal. And really, like, it just sounded like I was gurgling. And I remember someone looked at me and they're like, "Can you keep it down a bit?" And that was just the sound of my normal breathing at that point at 45 years of age. I was a far cry from healthy. At that point, I decided I did not have an alcohol problem. I did not have a cocaine problem. I didn't have a sex problem. I just had a problem with pot. It's no big deal. I have two Dutch parents, and my parents always said to me, "What's the problem? You're not drinking. This pot's fine. That never hurt anyone." Now, I understood I used pot the same way my grandfather's used alcohol, so I knew it was a problem. But, you know, I had just this much reinforcement, which was enough to tell me it was okay to keep going. About 5 days into going to meetings every day, an older gentleman at one of the meetings said to me, "So you're sure it's just a pot problem?" Hey, and I said, "Yeah, it's a pot problem." And he went, "Okay, cool. Look, here's my number. I want you to go out tonight, go have some dinner, go drink like a gentleman, and call me in the morning and let me know how it went." And that was the last time I ever got drunk. To speak to the last time I got drunk, May 11th, 2018 is my dry date. So I think that puts me just over 4 years at this point. If you're doing this, it works. I had to call that man and let him know how drinking like a gentleman worked out. It didn't. I don't remember leaving the bar. I don't remember paying my bill. I don't remember what I drank. And to this day, I see people that were working on the evening and they still kind of look at me funny. So I'm not really sure what I got up to. The truth is, every day thereafter, I understood I have a big old problem. And whatever one of these substances you want to take your pick. I'll find another one if those aren't there. What I came to learn here is that we've got an empty space inside of us, a void, and we pour substances and behaviors into it because that makes it all feel better. And the truth is, until you sit down with somebody and you admit you're powerless to this and you perform an inventory and go make some amends, you're going to fall prey to that very same thing. Once you start doing this stuff, you start to get a little power over all that BS and you can actually start to reel in your life. More importantly, you can call someone who's been there and done it before you and say, "Hey, I'm stuck. I'm having a really hard time." And they'll help you out of that. And I can say in the last 4 years, I've made that phone call a few times and it's probably saved my life. And the reason I'd say it was probably saved my life is, geez, I've had at least a dozen friends go out in the last 4 years that are no longer with us. Not that they're not going to meetings. They're dead. They're not coming back. They won't be coming back. And I understand in my mind that those are the stakes these days. I frankly got tired of being a loser. If you're still a drunk, I'm not calling you a loser. What I'm saying is myself as a mess was the biggest loser version of me I've ever been. And I'm enjoying having a happy life right now. I don't ever want to go back to that. And I know two things are going to happen if I slip and go back. I'm going to end up being that loser again. I'm probably going to die and hurt everybody around me that really cares for me. And I'm not much for hurting people. Never have been. Don't ever want to be. Somehow it seemed okay when I was hurting myself, but I've kind of given up on that. This program's given me a toolkit to live a happy life, positive life, a life where I can make a difference, where I can help people, where, you know, people can turn to me for a change rather than me with my hand out looking for help from everybody. I can actually put my hand up and offer some help to people. And boy, that's a fundamental change in my life. There's some people in this room that have really helped me and I can't thank them enough because frankly, I don't think I'd be here today. Life's really nice now. I don't mean this in a way to brag. I mean this to give hope to anybody who's new. Things are no longer unmanageable. And if they are unmanageable, I know a half a dozen people I can call and say, "Hey, can you please help? I'm stuck." And they do. And it's okay. If your life is not manageable today, it's fine. Call me, call any one of us. We'll be glad to help you. All I can really say is if you're new here, please do this again. Come back tomorrow, come back later today, come back anytime you can. We will all be glad to see you. And if you've been here a while, thanks for showing me the path and making this available to myself and people like me. Because had you folks not been out here before me trying and suffering and working so hard, I wouldn't have had a hope in hell. And instead, I'm alive today and life's good. And I've got all of you to thank for it. So that's been about 12 minutes. Will that leave time for everybody else to bump their gums a little bit? Nice. Thanks so much for having me today. I really appreciate it.
That's awesome. One of the things I loved about being right on the CAMH campus, the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, is we were you never knew who was going to show up in terms of faculty and clients and people from the neighborhood. It was always great to put on a meeting in the detox there, you know, no matter how big my problems were that I was frustrated with and going to pull my hair out over because of my cell phone plan or because of my RRSP, you know, like that was a real good Be Grateful Joe moment to go in the detox and share with people. And we still do it on Zoom, but it doesn't have that institutional smell. Elise.
No, I don't know how my internet's going to be. Thanks for inviting me. Oh my God, I'm so nervous. Okay, so it's really easy for me to talk with a room full of people I don't know, but I know all of you guys just about. And it's like, oh, you know me. This is completely different. But I decided to go for the jugular and talk about, not in general, but talk about one little story of my life that, I don't know, it's really up there on the top. But, and I made notes, because I don't want to bore you, because I can get lost. You know, when I go back and try to figure things out, the whys, I can get totally detoured and lost. So I want to do that. So where are we at? 218. Okay. I'm Elise. I'm 63. I was born in 1958 in New Jersey. My parents already had two other girls, so I was the third. And they got one more because my mom wanted a boy. That's important to the story. She wanted a boy. So it was pretty evident, very subtle and not so subtle ways. She treated us three girls very differently than she treated my brother. But regardless of all that, I was very happy as a child. My mother was constantly overwhelmed. She was not equipped to do parenting. She wanted that boy. She's very nervous, sarcastic, competitive with us as children. You know, board games she had to win against a five-year-old. Anyway, and my dad, he was a man of few words. He had really high expectations. He'd say things like, don't be like your mom. Don't need a man. Don't ever rely on a man. He wanted us to be liberated, independent women. He wanted us to break the glass ceiling. But he didn't really tell us how to do that. And the other thing he said was education is the key to success. So those are the kind of things. I had a lot of conflicting messages and a very nervous mom. But, you know, we lived in a neighborhood where the kids kind of, we brought up ourselves. It was a really nice little middle-class neighborhood with lots of places to roam. We'd walk down railroad tracks for miles and, you know, nobody missed us. And when we got hungry, we went home. And if I didn't go to my home, maybe I went to somebody else's home. There's always mom around to feed you and give you, and you could drink water from the garden hose. So, you know, and we had our bicycles. We got around, we did stuff, but, you know, we had the basics and pretty much only the basics. But, you know, I didn't know. We didn't have stuff. We had a bed and a house, a roof, and three meals. So anyway, what happened was when I was 11, we moved from Syracuse. We were in Syracuse then, where I had spent my whole childhood. I had quite a good group of childhood friends. We had the neighborhood. We had the community. We moved away from that to Rochester, to the outskirts of Rochester. Then my mother started working full time. She wasn't home. We were latchkey kids, which was also fine. My father got involved in politics, and little by little, he started not coming home in the evenings. And when he did come home, we had a nice new big house, which really aggravated me because we had a living room for the grownups and a den for the kids. So before we were not as well off financially, but we were close together. We were always hanging out in the living room in the evenings. Now we were separated. I didn't see my parents even in the house. My father would come home and make one of those tall tumblers of Manhattans and hide behind the newspaper. And so this was going on, and, you know, it's like weird. And my siblings all made friends and quickly went out into the world. And I found myself alone at home a lot. So what I did about that was a couple of things. And this has come up, I've heard this in meetings lately about needing attention. I was 11, 12, and I felt like I was alone in the house most of the time. No more family. Family was gone for various reasons. So I became the homemaker. I learned how to cook at 11. I did the housework. I even sewed outfits for my mother, you know, to get her approval. And, you know, I learned how to do that. And I give myself rewards. You know, I'd say once I clean all the bathrooms, I can have two cookies, you know, so give myself rewards. When that wasn't enough, when winter came, I had heard this comment from my mother a lot. Oh, you'll die of pneumonia. So I went outside barefoot with hardly any clothes. I sat in the snow until I got a good solid chill, and I got pneumonia. And I got to stay home for 6 weeks out of school, and my mother took care of me. So that's the setup. Now, this is kind of foggy. I don't know, you know, what happened first or next. But around that time, my mother started acting even weirder. She came in when we were sitting around watching, you know, all those TV shows, and held up an almost empty bottle of, I don't know, some kind of hard liquor. And she looked around the room and said, "Who drank this?" And I was 11. I had no interest in alcohol. And she accused me of drinking that alcohol. And that was kind of heartbreaking, you know. So there was that. But the big thing that happened was, so I did get friendly with a kid in the next neighborhood, and we were on the phone talking a lot, totally innocent. He came over on his little mini motorcycle that he made, and we went for a walk. And coming back home, walking up the hill, my two parents were driving down the hill, and they stopped the car. My mother started ranting. She accused us of having sex. She told me I was a disgusting animal. She said a lot of other things that I think I didn't hear a lot, but those are the things I remember. And I blocked this out of my mind till I was in my mid-30s. Actually, this is all stuff I didn't remember till I was in my mid-30s. So what did I write down? Mom went crazy. She went off the deep end. She accused me of being a disgusting animal. I internalized all the ugly things she said about me. My mind went numb. My heart broke. My mom hates me. My dad's sitting there and he's not saying anything. He's backing her up. I have no one who cares for me or about me, no one to protect me. So that's what happened to me when I was 12. And because she accused me of all those things and I internalized it, poor Dave, he was such an innocent bystander. We knew about marijuana. I wasn't into it yet. I don't know. It's like a switch went off and I became like this robot and I started doing all the things that she had been accusing me of. There was no reasoning. There was no thinking it through. I just went on automatic. So I grabbed David. We went to his brother's fort in the woods and we got high and we had sex. And then I worried for 2 months that I was pregnant, 12 years old. I'm worrying that I'm pregnant. Okay, so what I didn't know that was happening, right before we moved, my oldest sister filled me in with this. Right before we moved, my sister and my mother had a fight. My mother also accused her of stuff she wasn't doing. My sister, needing some comfort, went to stay with her boyfriend. And she got pregnant first time. What I didn't know was my sister didn't say anything about it until it was too late to terminate the pregnancy. And so she carried through with the pregnancy. I have no idea why I didn't even notice that. When the baby was born in the hospital, my mother was with her and they handed the baby to my mother. And my mother gave it to the nurse. She gave it away. So after learning that story, I'm reading my notes to see if I missed anything. So after that, I believe that that was the thing that put my mother over the edge. I believe that that was the moment when she became so irrational, and it all came out in anger, and it came out to everybody around her. My other sister, the sister who had the baby, me, my father, not my brother. So that started me in marijuana, and that's really pretty much the end of my story. Marijuana was more available. It was more acceptable with the kids I ran around with later on in high school. Oh, and I stopped going to classes. They just passed me along. I just hung out and got high and tried to get attention. Oh yeah. Anybody who would give me attention, whatever they wanted from me, they could have it, because I just needed that attention so desperately. And at one point, the marijuana was tainted with angel dust, and I had a really bad trip, and I lost my mind for a couple of weeks. So I went to the safety of alcohol. So that's the end of my story. What has changed? One thing over the years that I've learned from this, I don't want to use any of the words that are used for women, like promiscuity, loose. Those aren't used for men. But that's who I was. And what I've tried to get straight in my mind is that the world is not a fair place. Not only is it dangerous, it's not fair. Two people who are acting on nature's, you know, what we're given. We're naturally sexual human beings. Two people make a baby for whatever reason. And from that moment on, I learned as a female that it's the consequences all fall on me, all of them. He can step up, but he doesn't have to. My sister's boyfriend was completely out of the equation. He had zero consequences. My sister was damaged for life. My mother was damaged for life. They damaged me, and they damaged my other sister. And that's just a fact of life. I can't say, I don't like the word forgive, but I understand my mother. I have compassion for her. Until about year 8, maybe, in AA, I hated my mother. When these memories came back, I hated her for how she turned my life around. What would my life have been like if none of that had happened? But I've learned to just accept that it did happen. Those are the kind of things that happen. It doesn't seem fair. It doesn't seem right, but it just is. And I have compassion for my mother. I've always had compassion for my sister, because the kind of person I am, I cannot imagine the strength it took for her to do what she did for the welfare of her baby. Oh, yeah, because she was given an ultimatum at 16. She was told that if she kept the baby, she could not live at home. She wasn't welcome. It was too shameful. It would shame our family. So she could either give the baby away, or she could leave and disappear, baby. So that's what I grew up with. It's had a huge effect on me. It's completely intertwined with my using and drinking. And my first sponsor, on a lighter note, what changed? When I started AA, my first sponsor, I swear to God, was an angel. And I read her it took me a while to get this fourth step out. It took me about 3 or 4 times to get a halfway decent fourth step out. And she said, about all the stuff that happened to me when I was a child and a teenager, she said, and this is huge. And she used to say that, this is huge. She'd say, it wasn't your fault. It wasn't your fault. If there's one thing I needed to learn, and I learned in AA, it wasn't my fault. Thanks for letting me share.
Ah, thanks. listening to you talk, I think my first drug of choice was approval. I had this insatiable need or desire for approval, never felt worthy. I just sort of reflected on all of us, you know, our childhood and like just the shit that happens. And I'm a parent who parented in sobriety, and I didn't get it right. You know, so my kids have never seen me drunk, but there shouldn't be any surprise to them that someone like me really shouldn't drink. Thanks very much, Elise. David, don't know where I'd be without you. Come on in.
Hi, guys. Thanks, Joe. Yeah, I'm not in particularly great shape right now emotionally. I'm fighting another addiction, and it's causing me some grief, so hope I can get through this okay. And I would know where I'd be without you, Joe, and what you've created in Toronto. I'm really grateful to just the everything we have here. I think we're really, really spoiled in what we have here as far as alternative AA, because I've certainly heard a lot of unfortunate stories of people that have been in experience some of the issues that they've gone through in just other parts of just other geographic locations, as far as the fundamentalism that I've heard about. So, I'm not sure where to start. I wasn't quite sure where the parameters of this meeting were. I kind of focused on the CAMH meeting, but after hearing the first two shares too, I think I'd like to also just share some things about myself that I wasn't really planning to share when I came in here. Basically, I'm 64 years old. I just had a birthday a couple of weeks ago. And I am a belated alcoholic, I would say. I started drinking problematically when I was 48, which was probably unusual. I don't know statistically where that puts me. I would say my alcoholism was ripe for the picking, though. When I think back to the way I grew up in an alcoholic family. And, you know, it's one of those horrible things that just seems to have a lot of tentacles. And I just had a bit of a revelation just recently. I started working with a therapist last July, so it's been about 13 months. And I was talking about my mother innocuously in a meeting, and I was describing her as, and she was a very, the word that comes to mind when I think of her was she was a very childish woman. She was more like a child than she was an adult woman. Her ideas, her constructs, her beliefs, her values are what you would expect from really just a preteen child. I laid that out to her, and my therapist said something very interesting. I never really understood exactly what exactly happened to her, other than I was pretty confident that she went through a lot of neglect and abuse as a child herself, because she grew up in, she was born, I think, around 1917, and she and her parents immigrated to Canada in, I believe, 1923. They came over from Wigan, England, and settled in Wainwright, Alberta, which was at the height of its population is something like 5,000 people. It's right on the Alberta border. And I've wondered about whether there was any alcohol use in that side of my family, because I didn't see it with my mother. She was a total teetotaler. But I had some interaction online with a step cousin that I had, where she indicated that my grandfather, in her own words, said like to have a drink every now and then. Anyway, to get back to the point I was trying to make is my therapist just mentioned fetal alcohol syndrome to me. And that was a really interesting revelation, that is a very likely supposition of what my mother might have been inflicted with. It certainly does make a lot of sense. You know, it just seems like everywhere I look in this family, there was alcohol. My mother married an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. My mother's sister married an alcoholic. He died of a heart attack, I think, a year before I was even born. I think he probably was in his 40s at the time. My mother had a sister. She married an alcoholic, divorced him, evidently married another alcoholic. So it's all over the effing family. My father's father was an alcoholic, and he died of evidently bleeding of the stomach due to alcohol consumption a few years before I was born. So it was all over the place. I avoided it, though, for the most part. But I went through a lot of abuse when I was a child. My parents were just totally inadequate parents, quite frankly. They never really gave me what I wanted. And I think one of the things that really, for me, was a very, the biggest tragedy in my life was just never being protected from predators. I went through some really horrific abuse when I was 5 years old in Alberta. That's kind of the core of what I'm working on in my therapy right now, because I've been bearing it for a long time, and it's got a lot of a lot of tentacles that shoot up from that. And I would say the number one trauma that I went through that basically turned me into the person that I am today, which is somebody that's struggling with another addiction. I don't want to get too graphic here, but I have a sex addiction, and it's blossomed over the decades. And it's something that it was there basically since I was 12 years old. And it's something that predated my alcoholism, but I think it really gave birth to my alcoholism in an indirect way, because one of the consequences of it was just enormous isolation more than anything. I didn't know how to make friends. I didn't know how to be sociable. Very awkward, very lonely child, a lot of bullying in school. We moved around a lot. I was born in Edmonton. You could almost use the word emigrated from Alberta to Ontario when I was 12 years old, because my father lost his job and moved us out to a closer part of the country where he was from, to Woodstock, Ontario, actually. And I ended up interacting with a uncle who was a born-again Christian, and that's opened up another door in my therapy. So there's just so much shit here. I could go on and on and on and talk for hours about this, but I guess I'm just going to morph ahead a little bit to how I got here in the first place. Like I said, I started drinking out of loneliness when I was 48 years old, and it just started so innocently. I mean, I was always the one thing I always felt for most of my life that I could say about myself is I never fell into the same trap my father fell into. I never became an alcoholic, and I might've been an anomaly. I have a sister. I don't know how open she is about what she tells me, but I don't see any evidence that she fell into this trap either. But I've seen some Facebook postings that make me kind of realize a little bit about just making jokes about alcohol seems to be a common theme with her. So I wonder. I was in denial for a long time about my drinking. I started drinking every day it began when I was 48 years old, and it just blossomed and it exploded. I just denied it for a long time. And my drinking was very predictable. Every day I would wake up and proclaim that I'm not going to drink today. That would last for till the afternoon rolled along. And it was like a switch just went off in my head, and off I go to the LCBO. I haven't drank in 3.5 years, over 3.5 years, but that's still a point that's hitting me right now, because it's kind of similar to this other addiction that I'm experiencing right now, where it just seems to be the same effing pattern, where, I don't know, I wake up in the morning and I get through part of the day, and that switch is thrown. A lot of commonalities with addiction. This whole process is enveloping me. This whole, the world of an addict is just a totally different world. I'm learning a lot about myself, as horrific as my drinking was. And it's cost me an awful lot. It's cost me financially. It's cost me professionally. If I had career aspirations, they went in right into the toilet when I started drinking. I just became more and more isolated. I became more and more detached from the world, from the work, my work world, from my relationship world. But I'm learning a lot about myself, and it's kind of a double-edged sword. It's an education in and of itself. And it's a weird how addiction, it can be a way into the insanity, and it can be a way out of the insanity. And I don't quite understand what I mean by that, but because this is a work in progress for me, but I'm kind of coming out of it as well. I'm awakening out of it as well. And basically, I reached a point, I guess, with my drinking where I just started to break down emotionally. That's really the catalyst that got me into AA. I had some awareness of AA, and I had some awareness of the fundamentalism and the religiosity because of my father's drinking. I remember back, he would take me to the odd AA meeting. So I had some idea what it was like. And I just remember back in around April of 2018, I got on the computer because I know I needed help. And I started looking. I don't know what caused me. I can't remember exactly why, but I started focusing on trying to find a secular alternative, even though I don't even know if I had formulated those words in my mind at the time. But something drove me to that. And I don't know if that was a part of a spiritual awareness. Maybe it was. Maybe it was just something. There was a voice calling to me. But excuse me, just give me a minute too. I'm struggling today. Anyway, I don't know who was responsible for it, but there were some wonderful websites out there. Some people just prolifically putting some stuff on the web. And I found Beyond Belief, basically, in Toronto. And it took me a while to get to that meeting. It took me not too long, but the last thing I wanted was to walk into a meeting and break down emotionally. So it was a curious thing. I had to wait before I felt comfortable, emotionally comfortable, to come into a meeting. And I walked into OEC, walked into the room, met a gentleman there who unfortunately passed away a couple of weeks, just recently. I can't remember. I think it might have been 20. I can't remember if it was in 2020 or 2021, but he was by himself and setting up the meeting. And he was the first person who I met there. And as soon as I walked in the door, I never looked back. I was lucky. I was really, really lucky. I found my my people, and I found my tribe right away. Total acceptance. And it was actually the easiest thing in the world for me to come into AA. I struggled for about 6.5 months, drinking on and off. I just couldn't get it. I don't know why. I ended up doing an inpatient treatment at Renaissance House in Toronto. And it was supposed to have been a 28-day process. And I went in there and I lasted all of 5 days. I would say more than anything, the difficulty that I had was it triggered my PTSD a lot. I was very uncomfortable having to share a sleeping space with a couple of people who I didn't know. And I just snapped in the it was around 12 midnight. It was the roughest 5 days of my life emotionally. It was total torture. I would advocate it for people because it obviously worked for some, but for some reason, it just wasn't for me. So I just grabbed my bag and I checked myself out of there. The one thing I will say is I haven't drank since I got out of there. So I'm still not sure what happened. The light bulb went off. I had a conversation with a really wonderful, honest addiction counselor on my way out the door. He didn't try to talk me out of leaving. I think he knew I was pretty adamant that I was leaving, but he left me with a couple of ideas, and I can't remember how he put it. I'm paraphrasing here, but he really wasn't able to deal with his drinking until he realized alcohol wasn't his problem. His problem was himself. And that was one thing. And there was another point too, and it's just lost my, it's escaped me now. So then my sober date is December 3rd, 2018, 2 days before I went into the place. Marfa, I had a couple of months, and I just want to touch on this. It's 2:48 right now. I guess we're closing in on the hour, but I just wanted to bring it up too. Just the, I talked about with Joe was the CAMH meeting. Joe, I would put it on to you. That was your brainchild. But I remember how it came about. We were sitting in the after meeting at in Tim Hortons after Boise, and you suggested it would be nice to have a in-person meeting in Toronto when none really existed. And you put it on to me, and I never asked you why, but I kind of got the impression you were trying to give me some service there, because I was all 1 month, 2 months sober. I was still early in early sobriety, and I, you know, at that point it was still touch and go. Like I said, I had no idea that this time around I was going to stay sober compared to the prior times when I would drink. I would stay sober for a period of time and then go out again. But you pitched it on to me, and I'm really grateful that you did, because I went out and I grabbed it. And, you know, I contacted Cam H. You found a wonderful guy. Sean is his name. He gifted us the room. The Sacred Space Room in Toronto, for anybody out of town listening, wondering who Cam H, what Cam H is. It's the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto, and they have a few campuses in Toronto, basically. And we started the meeting up. It was a wonderful meeting every week. I took the responsibility on to make a point to be there every week. We managed to get to our 1 year anniversary before we got shut down with COVID. But it was a wonderful meeting to me. And it was just, there's something about service in AA that does keep you sober. There's something about responsibility. Even today, I was just struggling with my issue today and couldn't do anything about acting out or anything, because I knew I had to be here. So I could go into, I got more details here. I think I'll just wrap it up, though, and just say, this really sucks. It really does. Addiction is hell. What I'm holding on to is it's a paradox, and it's a dichotomy, because it's also a way out of the black. Out of the darkness. I don't know if I would have taken this journey that I'm taking right now to get out of my darkness if I hadn't become an alcoholic. And that's all I'll say. Glad to be here. Thanks for asking me, Joe. And I'm grateful for these meetings, and I'm grateful for the support network that I've gotten. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Thank you very much. Thanks, Mark and Elise, too. Just wonderful. Like, I've seen a lot of people come and go in recovery, and I remember David was looking so forward to getting into a treatment place, and we all were hopeful for him. This is what he needs. This is what he needs. And then when he walked out a few days into it, said, you know, this is, you know, I'm leaving. There was nothing when he came to the meeting that said, I have had my last drink. There nothing remarkable, nothing that said he was destined to fail. But the interesting thing I find about people in their recovery is it's a lot of little things every day, more often than it's a big aha moment. And I see more people get sober under the most difficult circumstances, where having everything go right for them didn't work out. And I think that's an interesting thing about AA. If you know me, you know it's get busy time when your feelings start to rise and you're not sure what to do with them. It's the only thing I know what to do with fellow alcoholics. And if you want to talk to me, sure, we're going to the district committee meeting. Come with me. We're going to intergroup. Come with me. We're going to start a meeting. Come with me. We're putting on a meeting in a hospital or an institution. Come with me. And David's been, he's done a lot more work than he's talked about. You know, he's been very active in the Beyond Belief group too. He does not love district committee meetings, but he loyally attended for us there. Because the Tuesday CAM H meeting is in what we call District 12 of Area 83, we're sort of Eastern Ontario International. We're on north of the Lake Ontario along St. Lawrence River, which divides Canada and the U.S., but we have a district or two that are actually in upstate New York. So they cross the border to attend our area assembly. And then our area continues on to the sort of Quebec border, to the Ottawa River. A little, you don't always get geography, but here you go. You know, area assemblies, district committee meetings, definitely not David's cup of tea, right? But he went and same with Don, who also sends his regrets. He was the past serving general service rep for this group, who brought us, amongst other things, a month of putting on meetings in the Monroe Center, which is a women's treatment center. And they're still attending the Monday Beyond Belief works out for them. And I saw them there Saturday as well, the Monroe Center, to sort of log on. And that's because we sent our very best to them, to the Women's Center, and I wasn't amongst them. You never know what's going to be coming next in recovery, are you? Hey, Marcia, what you doing? I'm getting that look. Okay. When you...
Sorry, what's going on?
No, I just said, hey, Marcia, what's going on? I was calling on you. Oh. If you can share a little bit.
Oh, share a little bit. Oh, okay. Sorry, you kind of sort of caught me off guard. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. My problem is Marcia. I'm dealing with house things right now. We have a broken pipe thing and like water is going everywhere and I got to find plumbers and stuff. And I don't know how to do that. You know, I once almost lost this house, to my mom by writing a whole bunch of checks once. And now I'm being responsible for it. So it's kind of weird. It's been a great meeting. I've enjoyed everything that I've heard. I joined the Queen Street group. Well, my sponsor told me that I needed to find a physical meeting to go to, because I left the mainstream meeting here. And I said, I'll have a lot of online meetings. And they said, no, you need a physical meeting. And so I popped into the Queen Street meeting and I've been going there since. I'm actually really looking forward to when they open up again and start doing the detox meetings and things like that. I worked at Renaissance Treatment Center for a while, so I know the importance of it. And so David, thank you so much, David and Joe, for all of the work that you put in previous to that. Yeah, that there's nothing like that service when it comes to helping the next one that comes along. Elise and Mark, thank you both so much for sharing the details of your stuff going on, you know. And it's like that, I have a sense when it comes to the Beyond Belief, and I'm going to refer to them as Beyond Belief family. I mean, I'm part of the Queen Street meeting. I'm part of the Steps to Freedom Women's meeting. Not so much like the bigger part, but you know, the people in those meetings, I have a huge sense of family with the Beyond Belief group, and I'm very grateful for them. And just for what they've done, like here within Toronto, and just how they've like welcomed, like when they welcomed me and when I came in, but just the welcoming atmosphere that you get in all the Beyond Belief meetings. I'm just going to be grateful for that today and try not to let anything else come in and destroy that, because I'm in that sort of mood where I could destroy things very easily right now. Like, so I'm just going to sit here and enjoy the rest of the day today and try and find a plumber and be grateful that I have the fellowship that I do, especially the fellowship here in Toronto. Yeah, so that's about it. That's all I got to say. Yeah, just keep your head out of your butt and do the next right thing.
Thanks. Good plumber advice. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Joe.
Okay, we're going to, for the balance of the meeting, we'll probably hang out another 20, 30 minutes or so, but we'd love to hear from anyone and everyone who would like to share. Let's kick off with Jeb.
Thank you, Joe. Wow. I just want to thank Mark, Elise, and David for such very generous and personal sharing today. I'm still having a hard time holding back tears because of the things that you brought up that are part of my life and the lives of others that I love, I have loved so much. And, you know, looking back at the things in the formative years that shaped my personalities, your personalities, and present things that we just need one another for support in dealing with these things. And, you know, one of the reasons that I came back to after my first meeting is I heard a lot of hope and encouragement there. And I still go to meetings to hear hope and encouragement, as well as hear the warning signs of things that could retard my progress. I really believe that practice makes progress. And if I ever stop doing the things that I hear others talk about and that I've learned work, I run the risk of going back to old addictions, which I, or for me, distractions from myself and defenses against allowing anyone to get really close to me. I can't afford that. And, you know, I'm what, 2 decades older than David. And I've shifted addictions so many times over the last 40 some years. And the one that raises its ugly head and has for at least the last, oh my gosh, at least the last 30 years has been sexual or relationship addiction. And it's something that seems to be under control most of the time when I'm really taking care of myself and practicing the self-care things. But it can just crop up out of the blue and shock me that, you know, I have compulsive ideas. And I never feel good after acting on them. It's like I never felt good when I drank more, smoked more, and drug more, and all that sort of thing. Always looking for that sort of relief from whatever it is. But I'm relieved that in secular AA, in the last couple of years, I've met a couple of other people with whom I could talk out all of this. And my disappointment with myself, and try to look at what are the things that I can do to just become more comfortable with being uncomfortable. Because I know that all of my addictions are an attempt to find pleasure or comfort and to deal with discomfort. So you all three give me a hell of a lot to think about. And the last thing I really respect so much is even though all three of you have talked about some of the things that happened that other people did during formative years. They were all three examples of talking about ourselves rather than someone else, because AA has taught me that, well, I think it's true for everybody, I'm responsible for my own happiness, joy, and freedom. And I hear that much more in secular AA than I ever heard it in traditional AA. So I'm still working on a day at a time. Today is day 16,052. And if I don't drink and I don't die, I can add one more day tomorrow. So thanks again for just that. I really thought such generous and personal sharing. Love you all three and the rest of my happy friends.
Well put, Jeb. Thank you very much. Another who has done their tour of duty and helping out the Toronto meetings, because a lot of people have been involved. Now, no one's been in more Toronto traffic than Bob Kay, compared to the rest of us in the room. But Greg served as a treasurer and many other things in some of the Toronto meetings. And why don't you come on in?
Thanks, Joe. Hi, everyone. Greg, a grateful alcoholic, living as it so happens on the doorstep of CAMH. It's right across the street. I can see it out my window here in Toronto. But I guess I was going to remark on the point of gratitude. And so, first of all, thank you to our speakers, Mark, Elise, David. I've heard from or seen you in meetings in some cases, but not others. I appreciate your recounting your story for us. And in particular, I was kind of struck, Mark, when you were talking about, reminded me of when I first started walking in the rooms, and I was just blown over, shocked and awe that there was this program, you know, all you had to do was stop trying to drive the train, sit down, shut up, and you're going to help me stop drinking. It's that simple. Like, sign me up yesterday. And I was very pleasantly amazed. And the people hanging out for 5 or 10 or 15 years, I mean, to some people, one reaction is, God, haven't you had enough? Isn't it time for you to get on with your life? Why don't you, you know, get out of the room, make there some room for somebody else? I thought everybody in there was going to be, you know, 30, 33, and they're in for 6 weeks. And then, you know, okay, I've learned and get lost now, pal. But no, the people hang around and it kind of kept me coming back. It kept me thinking, why do people still want to come? You know, it was like an enduring secret. And I just had to find out. So that I did and am trying to do and will try to continue to do. So thanks for listening to me today. Have a great Sunday.
Thanks so much, Greg. Short commercial message. Upcoming International Conference of Secular AA Secular Story Time, first Sunday of the month. I'm trying to find a way to say that where it just rolls off the tongue and sounds sort of snappy, but it's still working on it. Megan's helped a little bit with polishing off the wording there, but we're still maybe not right there. But that's the cool thing about secular AA. There's no experts here. We're all sort of co-flounders of secular AA on the Zoomiverse. Yeah, it's great to be in a room where people, I go, I know you, I know you, I know you. It's so very cool. But coming up in the next few months, we'll be hearing from Jersey City, Belfast, Pine Grove, Virginia, known as Pine Groove to some people, and Beyond Belief Cincinnati is going to be taking the lead too. And if you're thinking, well, hey, I'm not in any of those groups, what about our group? You'll be next. Just email us, secularaa@gmail.com. We'd love to get your group more involved too. Would anyone else like to share? I'd love to hear from you. This will be hard on people listening on the tape. Come on. Couple of things. Save the chat if you haven't already. It's got some information on if you want to make a seventh tradition contribution to the International Conference of Secular AA. You can do that. These meetings are free, generously put on by volunteers, and on a Zoom site that was already there. So, but if you want to contribute, by all means. There are upcoming things. We do need more people to get involved. If you want to get involved in our, John, I'm going to call on you to actually make that announcement. That'd be fantastic. But if you want to get involved in the planning of this upcoming virtual conference, again, we have no experts. Just join us and flounder along with the rest of the committee. That would we'd be happy to have you. secularaa@gmail.com. Just it might take a couple of days to get back to you, but you're welcome to come join us Sunday. Unless you hear otherwise, we'll just have it right on this Zoom account. That'll be great. John, what's going on at Verde Valley on the last Sunday of every month?
Yes, well, Joe, on the last Sunday of every month, we have a variety of secular experience navigating AA in a secular way. And this next one, I promise, it's going to be Jeffrey Munn this time. We got our wires crossed last time, so we kind of winged it, and Joe did a great job of helping us out with that. But this next or the last Sunday of this month, it'll be Jeffrey Munn talking about staying sober without God and whatever else he wants to talk about. And hopefully y'all will show up and talk about your own experience of staying sober. Maybe Joe can put that in the chat for people to...
Let me just make it easier for you to do so. Is the chat open? Chat should be open. Mm-mm. Let's chat. Come on, allow participants to chat.
By the way, I do want to say thank you to the speakers. It was really great. I really identified with so much of what you all had to share. And it was really nice to actually hear somebody talk about sex addiction in an AA meeting. That topic is one that I've been shut down many times trying to talk about in mainstream AA. So thank you.
Zanner.
Good day, folks. Zanner here. Thank you, everyone, for your shares. I figured I'd just do a little bit of a plug then. We've started a Freethinkers Sex, Love, Anonymous meeting. We meet every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern time. I'll put the information in the chat if anyone's interested.
Well, since we're doing that, I'll plug a meeting too, just to get the word out. There is, I have found a Sex Addicts Anonymous meeting that's secular. And interestingly, when I was there the last time, they read Beyond Belief, Gil's book. So I'll look up the day of the week. I think it's on Wednesday. The one I'm referring to, it's on Wednesday. I think the Monday meeting, if I'm not mistaken, it's just a phone-in meeting. But what I'm alluding to, it's on Wednesday, I believe, 9 o'clock Eastern time. So I'll dig the... I'll try to dig the link up for that and put it in the chat too, if anybody's interested. It's a start anyway. I think it's something that's really just desperately needed, and I hope that can grow, and I hope we can find a way to get the word out and help it to grow.
Thank you. Not an outside issue. One of the panels we're going to have at the virtual conference is one that we were going to have at the face-to-face Washington conference, and it's a panel of members from other fellowships, from secular NA, secular CODA, secular Al-Anon, secular OA. Yeah, it's I'm certainly looking forward to that. Well, with that said, we close with see you next time, and thanks for coming.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, David, Mark, Elise.
Thanks, everybody. Yep.